This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Humanism has become a really important topic to me, and as I've gotten farther on in my career, I find that it's really important to me to stay focused on humanism, but also hopefully to help trainees and colleagues stay focused on humanism. So we're going to do a little bit of a journey today, and I hope you'll just take the next hour to just take time to reflect on some of the things I'm going to say and maybe some of the experiences you've had yourself. So my only disclosure is that I have received funding from the Cameron Kravitz Foundation, and I'll be showing a video that was supported by that foundation. So the objectives of today are to understand the intersection of humanism with pediatric end-of-life issues, consider the perspectives of parents and acknowledge their emotions, to learn specific communication strategies for sharing bad news. And I imagine there are many people in the audience who are very skilled at this, but sometimes it's good to just have a quick refresher. To appreciate the impact on healthcare providers from our personal and professional experiences, and learn ways to address our own humanistic qualities through promoting our well-being. So I'd like you to take a minute to just imagine the following. So you are working in a community hospital, you're the inpatient attending, and a 9-month-old child gets admitted to your service. This child has had a fever for 2 days, has been breathing a little bit rapidly. When you do your exam, you note that the temperature is 39.5, which is quite elevated, has an elevated respiratory rate, pulse ox is about 92%. On chest x-ray, you noticed questionable perihilar infiltrates, so the child's admitted, is put on IV antibiotics and oxygen. About 12 hours into the hospitalization, the nursing notes on the monitor that there's an abnormal rhythm and then a systole. There's no heart rate. You and your team quickly go to the bedside. You try to resuscitate the child. Despite 30 to 45 minutes of really aggressive resuscitation, the child has died. Since you're at a community hospital, there's not the option to do ECMO or other more aggressive things. So just take a minute to kind of think about that. Now you need to disclose that news to the family. Think about it from their perspectives. Here they had, you know, brought their child in thinking the child was just mildly ill, and now the child has died. Also thinking about from your perspective, kind of rethinking your decision making. Was there some like clinical component that you missed? And it's a lot of those two perspectives that we're going to focus on today during this grand rounds. So what is humanism? And to be honest, I've not seen one definition. I've actually seen several, but this is the one that I've chosen and what I like the best. And this is by Dr. Pellegrino, who's a well-known ethicist. He states humanism is a set of deep-seated personal convictions about one's obligations to others, especially those in need. And it encompasses a spirit of sincere concern for the centrality of human values in every aspect of professional activity. The history of humanism in medicine is quite rich, and it really starts back to Hippocrates and is embedded in our Hippocratic Oath, where it's the physician's duty to benefit the sick and keep them from harm and injustice. Then in 1902, Sir William Osler made a very famous quote, and forgive me, being from Hopkins, there'll be a couple Osler quotes, so I just really like him. But anyway, he once said, "It is much more important to know what sort of person has a disease than what sort of a disease a person has." So when you look back, you know, I think the origins of social determinants of health really go way back and probably over a century. Then in 1927, Francis Peabody wrote a paper on the care of the patient and focused a lot on the balance between the science and art of medicine. In 1983, the American Board of Internal Medicine published a statement on humanism, and because of I was a president of the Academic Pediatric Association several years ago, and my platform was humanism, I then looked in the literature to see, well, where's the pediatric statement on humanism? And there is not one. And I was really surprised by this. I actually called colleagues at the American Board of Pediatrics. I asked, how is this possible? And they said, well, humanism is really embedded under professionalism. But there's a group of us that are starting to work on a humanism statement within pediatrics. And then, as you're probably aware, the Arnold Gold Foundation has really made it their platform with ceremonies such as the White Coat Ceremony. But again, I was really intrigued by this difference between professionalism and humanism, and I found this paper by Dr. Cohen. He defines professionalism as a way of acting, observable behaviors that meet the expectations of patients. Examples of this include competency, confidentiality, fulfilling responsibilities, where humanism is a way of being, a set of deep-seated convictions of others, especially those in need. And examples of that include altruism, integrity, respect for others, and compassion. And humanism is the passion that animates professionalism. So, as Sharon had mentioned, I trained in clinical research. I've been taught to do kind of public health research, look at large populations, and that's what really excites me, like striving for large sample sizes. But as I've gone on in my career, what I've found is probably equally, if not more important, is who are those individuals in those large populations? So as you look at this one individual here, what are her perspectives? What are her needs? And to me, it's those individual relationships that have made my career so fulfilling. So the practice of medicine is really a balance between the science and art. The science, which includes diagnostics, technology, and cure, and the art, which includes humanism, communication, and healing. And it's the concept of this dual intelligence, that the practice combines the life sciences with humanism. The science and art are not antagonistic, both are essential. And this is what we really strive to teach within our residency program. So humanism, why has humanism become maybe more popular or more apparent now? And I think many people are really migrating towards palliative care and global health, at least a lot of our trainees are. And I think part of that is that the desire to get back to the doctor-patient relationship. These are areas where there's not a lot of technology involved, and it's really about your relationship with the patient and what can you provide. Susan Block wrote this article about the components of humanism, and this has really been kind of a beacon for me. She talks a lot about the importance of focusing on patient and parents' perspectives and emotions, effective communication, importance of the doctor-patient relationship, the value of doctoring as a source of meaning and growth, and our role as healers, and the impact of our experiences on healthcare providers, the importance of taking care of ourselves. So I'm going to go through a couple of concepts. So first, parental perspectives or societal perceptions of death. So I was a medical student at Northwestern in Chicago, and during my medical school, I never had one patient die. I then had the opportunity to go to Zazzau, Liberia, and I worked there for 3 months. And during my time there, over 40 patients died. What did they die of? They died of infection, they died of malnutrition, they died of injuries. And while it was really fascinating to work in that culture, these parents loved their children tremendously, but children were not officially named until 4 years of age. And the reason for that, it was a rite of passage. If you survived until 4 years of age, the likelihood was you would survive into adulthood, or at least into adolescence. And these families loved their children tremendously, but death was actually kind of the cycle of life. In the United States, fortunately, death has become very infrequent, and that's really great. And as a clinician and as a pediatrician, I strive very, very hard to cure my patients and do the very best I can for them. Intermittently through my presentation, I'm going to show you some artwork that I found particularly meaningful. And this is a painting that was painted in 1920 by a painter named Ivor Saliger. And this is entitled Radiation Therapy. So this was a painting that was painted when radiation therapy first came into being, and this woman has a tumor. But what I find very interesting in this painting is that this is death. So death is depicted as very diabolical, something to avoid with all consequences. Next is medical expectations of cure. So I feel very fortunate to practice medicine right now. We avail ourselves of our own diagnostics, we have immunizations, we have amazing medications. Surgery has really transformed medicine also. You know, now patients can get bone marrow transplants when they have oncologic issues or liver failure. And also when I think back in over the last 10 years, children with intractable seizures can have a hemispherectomy and be cured of their seizures. So really amazing interventions are available to us and to our patients. But again, why humanism and why now? It's a lack of empathy and compassion often accompany an uncritical reliance on technology and pressing economic considerations and results in major failures of the current medical system. So I think all of us are very focused on cure, focused on what can we do for the patient. And I'm not at all meaning to minimize that. That's critically important. But sometimes there arises time where more cure and more technology is not really available. Also changes in communication. I was talking with Heidi Wu, who was gracious enough to invite me and some colleagues out to dinner last night. And, you know, with distant computer order entry, you don't have to be at the bedside to order. You don't have to talk to nursing to make an order. Also, with work hour reductions, it's sometimes hard to really maintain some of that continuity with patients. So all of these things that are happening in our healthcare system are kind of working against humanism. Also, a child's death is a disruption of the natural order. I know when I see a child, I see hope. I see resilience. I see, you know, what's the thing that we oftentimes ask children? What do you want to be when you grow up? You're already planning for the future. Parents are thinking about who will they marry and will they be happy and will they become grandparents. So it's very future-oriented. However, when a child is sick and sadly dies, it's really a very tragic event. It's tragic from so many aspects. I think, obviously, it's tragic to the parents, and it's devastating. And in the literature, it's really been quoted that that's the number one most devastating experience for a parent, much more than the death of a spouse or the death of their parents. Also, I think as clinicians and healthcare providers, we oftentimes see death as a failure. What did we do wrong? Did we disrupt the trust of the patient and of the parent? And so I think what's evolved is that while we always should strive to do the very best we can for our patients, when that's no longer possible, we look at that as a medical error or as a failure. And it's put us in a very, very difficult position, I think, both personally and also with the public. This is from a book by Dr. Salmasi, who is both a clinician and also a theologian. And he talks about the concept of healing is wider than the concept of curing. Clinicians heal through being there with their patients. They need write no orders. They need perform no tests. They need speak no words. A clasp of the hand will often be enough. So stressing the importance of our presence with patients and the strength of that. There also are educational needs and opportunities. So here's another painting. My hunch is some of you have seen this. This is entitled Medical Education, and it was painted in 1882. This is the picture that's on a lot of the medical education textbooks. So again, let's look at two different perspectives. When I look at the perspective of the clinicians in the audience, what do I see? I see really enthusiastic people craning their necks to see this. What this is depicting is this is the very first demonstration of anesthesia during a procedure. So very interested clinicians, et cetera. Then I look at the patient. Now, fortunately, the patient is under anesthesia, so is not seeing all this. But I wonder what their perspective was. Were they excited to be part of this? Did they feel like they were being experimented on? At first, I thought maybe this person here, this clinician, was holding her hand, but really what he is doing is taking her pulse. So again, I think when we're in interactions, it's important to be thoughtful about what's the perspective of the patient. And again, this is a picture that's depicted on many medical education textbooks. Contrast this with a painting that was from the 1300s, and this is a midwife who's feeding a patient, again, directly addressing that patient's needs. I've learned as I've been studying humanism more that the word patient comes from the Latin word patiens, which means to suffer. And I find that very kind of inspiring on a daily basis, that every patient that comes to me is suffering at some level, whether it's physically, whether it may be mentally, maybe socially. But that's really our goal, is to address that suffering. And to journey with a patient through their suffering may be the most rewarding aspects of our career. And I certainly feel, as I remember back on my career, that certainly is the case. I wanted also to talk about this paper that was written by Steve Miller. I don't know if some of you knew Steve. Steve was an emergency medicine doctor at Columbia, and he had a focus on humanism. And sadly, he was actually killed in a plane crash as he was going to give a talk on humanism. But what he talks about is the habit of humanism, and can humanism be taught? And I truly believe humanism can be taught. And here's how he suggests we do that. That it's so important to identify multiple perspectives, the perspectives of the patient, of the parent, and also of ourselves as healthcare providers, and reflect how do they converge or conflict. And once we've reflected on that and can identify that, we can have a great dialogue then with the family. And finally, and I find this very powerful, is that we can choose to act altruistically. I can get up every morning and make a choice, but one choice is to act altruistically. So we have that ability to do that with our patients and with our colleagues. Also with educational experiences, I found that the death of a patient is one of the most powerful experiences of pediatric residency. During my first year of internship, a patient that I cared for died, and it had a profound impact on me, actually for quite a while. It then kind of led me on a journey to research this a bit, and I'll show you some of the research I've done with residents upcoming in some of the slides. But what I found really intriguing is I started to interview very well-respected mentors, people who'd been in practice for 60 years or who were at my institution for 60 years, could remember the name, the age, and the circumstances of the first patient that had died. And I found that to be really amazing. So it spoke to me because I certainly could, although I was only 5 or 10 years past that event. But what a powerful experience that is, I think, for healthcare providers. Yet there's been little training or preparation, and few residency programs really address this issue. I'll show you some research. This was from Dr. Ahrens, and this looked at emergency physicians. So these were attendings. 66% reported informing the parent of a child's death was the most difficult part of ED medicine. Only 14% had received any training, and 92% wanted more training. Here's an article that looks at parents' experiences and preferences in communicating medical bad news. This was actually not about death, but about patients who had developmental delay. So the first column shows their preference and the second experience. So you can see under all wanted to be demonstrated caring, although that was higher than what they actually experienced. They wanted to be allowed to talk, and they wanted to be allowed to show their emotions and feelings. They wanted confidence in the part of the provider. Again, that was their preference was higher than what they experienced. They wanted referrals to other parents. So I think this is very important as we're identifying families whose children have certain diseases or certain conditions. To be able to link them up with parents who've journeyed in the same way is very powerful to them. And also, they wanted physicians to show feelings. And this has been very interesting, and later maybe in the discussion you can comment on this, but culturally sometimes it's been discouraged that the clinician should show feelings, that it's unprofessional. And sadly, this was first attributed to my friend Sir William Osler. So he gave this talk to medical students called Equanimity. And what equanimity means is keeping calm in the face of adversity for the sake of the patient. So that makes total sense, right? You're in a crisis. Of course, you want to keep your head. You want to be aggressive. You want to do everything you can to save that patient. So they interpreted that, or some have interpreted that, as it's not professional to show emotion. But what they didn't know is that there was more to this quote. And the other part, I thought it was very interesting. He then said, "Cultivate then such a judicious measure of obtuseness," this is hard to read actually, "as will enable you to meet the exigencies of practice with firmness and courage without at the same time hardening the human heart by which we live." So I think he was acknowledging that after the event, it was very important to show compassion and to both yourself and to the patient. It's also important to acknowledge parents and family members' emotions. So anyone recognize this painting? Anybody know the name of this? Scream. So everyone knows the name of this. I see this at Halloween all the time. But it's very interesting. I don't know if you know the background behind this painting. This was painted, this was Victor Munch, and he was 16 years old at the time, and his sister had died of tuberculosis. So again, I think this is a pretty powerful message of how, of kind of the horror that is of when a very beloved person in your family dies. I'm now going to show you a video clip, and quite a while ago, I guess it was in 1995, I was approached at Hopkins by a family, the Kravitz, and they were a family in Chicago. They had had a difficult experience when their child had died. Their child actually died at the time of childbirth, and they came to us because their experience was so unfortunate, they asked us to then design a resident curriculum to help residents to do a better job. Mr. Kravitz is a very high-powered lawyer. He works out of New York now. And I tell you that because he speaks nationally and internationally all over the world. Yet what you're going to see is he's going to be reading a script. And the reason he reads it is he said he couldn't really get through it unless he read it. And at the time of this taping, the death of their child, Cameron, was 20 years prior. So I'd like to show you a very brief clip of his comments and his experience of his and his wife.
Try to imagine you are not a doctor. You are a pregnant woman. For 9 months, you have felt a child grow inside of you. For weeks now, you have put your hand on your stomach and stared out the window in that abstracted way only pregnant mothers can. By looking out, you are really looking within. You arise in the middle of the night, travel in the dark and bitter cold of Chicago, January, to the hospital. You are so excited with anticipation that you can hardly control yourself. When you arrive, the nurses and the intern tell you that the baby has no heartbeat. There must be some mistake. You are confused. How can 9 months of life be reversed in 90 seconds? You start negotiating with God. Oh God, let him be born alive and I'll do everything that I know I should do, but I don't, for the rest of my life. Please, God, please. You are on the delivery table. You are pushing and breathing. You give birth to your own dead child. He has a name even. It is Cameron. He is born. How sweet he looks. You hold him and feel the warmth that still clings to him. How precious he is. How precious he could have been. Someone takes him away from you. You are seized with an overwhelming sense of loss. He is gone. You never, ever see him again. There is no picture, no photographs, just a memory so thin that you can see through it. But he leaves an aching hole in your heart, so wide that it has no boundaries. You have lost a part of your future that you will never be able to get back. Now the doctor is gone. The nurse prepares to take you to the maternity ward. Your husband explains to the nurse that lying awake, staring at the ceiling, listening to newborns and their parents isn't a good idea. So they take you to the cancer ward. You are surrounded by real death, real misery. The nurses do not even know how to treat you. There is no follow-up. The doctor is gone. There is no one to talk to. There is no one to listen. There is no one to say that everything will be all right. There is no one who takes the time to understand what you have lost. How will you explain to your 3-year-old daughter what has happened? Will she be devastated by the loss or consumed with guilt, thinking perhaps that her jealousy of a new brother had the effect of killing him? Indeed, how do you tell your daughter what has happened at all? What will happen after you recover physically? How will you be able to go through another pregnancy without terror? Indeed, what if your husband wishes you to try again, but you cannot bring yourself to try once more? Will the death of your child cause the death of your marriage? Thomas Mann wrote in The Magic Mountain that, quote, a man's dying is more the survivor's affair than his own, unquote. How true that is. You are doctors. You are members not of a mere profession, but a calling, making people well when you can, alleviating their pain and suffering, which you almost always can. I'm here to tell you 2 very simple things. First, when a child dies, there is a pain in the heart of a man or a woman that surpasses even the physical pain of the delivery. It is a wound in the soul that leaves one devastated and forever changed. It is a reversal of fortune so terrible that a human being almost cannot grasp the terror of its dimensions. Second, through neglect or indifference, you can make that pain even worse, or, and this is God's gift of grace to each of you as doctors, you have the ability within you to alleviate that pain. You cannot eliminate the loss or the suffering that attends it, but you can soften it. You can make it understandable. You can make a mother or father, you can enable a mother or a father to bear it and to begin to come to terms with the likely most devastating moment of their lives. When a child dies, it is gone forever. All the potential that it could have fulfilled is forever lost. But the love that it leaves behind is there for a doctor to help to mold within the parents' breasts.
Mr. Kravitz comes every year to our seminar. We've been giving it for 18 years now. And as you can imagine, it's a very powerful presence to, again, get the perspective of parents and to really inspire us to both create the best seminar we could and also to help create the best physicians that we can. So I'm going to talk with you now about some of the educational goals of the seminar and then show you some data from it. So the goals were to gain expertise in talking with parents about death and dying, and we give this seminar during the second year of our pediatric residency. Residents interact with standardized patients, and then they get feedback from their colleagues and the standardized patients. And then very important, I think, to practice and experience how it feels to be in these emotionally charged situations. We have two scenarios. One is an acute sudden death in the ED. The resident has no prior relationship with the family. And the other is an unexpected death in a patient with chronic illness. And the script is scripted so that the resident does have a relationship with that family. And again, it's facilitated by a faculty member and four other residents. So here are some strategies in sharing bad news. And I just wanted to review these with you as a group. This is also what we focus on during the seminar. The importance of setting up the interview, determining who participates, actually sharing the news, anticipating parents and own reactions, and then after the disclosure. So setting up the interview. And again, I can see in the audience there's many skilled clinicians here, so I just hope that this will be a good review for everyone. The importance of choosing a private place, somewhere where you can be that's protected and uninterrupted, and arranging the room so everyone can be seated so you appear to be not rushed. The physician who knows most about the circumstances or has the closest relationship with the family should be the disclosure of news. I think I'm remembering a case of a patient that I identified who had an oncologic process, and it was very helpful that both I and the oncologist could be there at the same time. I knew the family better, but the oncologist could give more information about what came next. Also, telling both parents at the same time. It's very important for a variety of reasons. One, because they'll get support from each other. Two, it's very difficult to tell one parent and then expect them to go home and tell the other parent. The other parent will have countless questions, and that first parent may not really be able to remember all the answers. Also, including another healthcare professional. I think that's very important also, again, as a sign of support to the family. But also, I know sometimes when I'm sharing bad news, I may be so focused on the word choice, I might miss cues, I might use a word or medical jargon that the family might not understand, and this other healthcare professional can kind of correct that or identify it. And if you're brave enough, that person can give you feedback later to tell you how they thought that it went. Also, you want to discourage unnecessary participants. I work at a large medical center just like you do, and I think it's critically important for students and residents to observe and be involved with sharing bad news. But what I mean by discouraging unnecessary participants, you don't want to have a crowd of 10 or 20 people in there. You know, if people are directly related with the case, that makes sense that they could be there. Just kind of look at these two pictures. So in this picture, you see the clinician is standing, arms folded. I don't know what your reaction is, but you can kind of see the mom is really exhausted. She's kind of holding up her head. I get a sense of distance, maybe disinterest, maybe being hurried. Contrast that with this. If you feel comfortable actually making, you know, physical contact with the family, they're at the same eye level. This person appears to have much more time with the family and I think makes a better connection. Sharing the news, the importance of knowing and using the parent and child's name. That's easy if you know the family, more difficult if you're in the PICU or ED and they've suddenly come in. But taking the time to know that before you start the encounter, I think is important. Knowing the gender. I've made this mistake a couple times, and once you do it and you see the look of horror on the family's face, you will never do it again. The importance of using a warning phrase, you know, something like, I am so very sorry, but I have some bad news to share with you. The importance then to getting to the point quickly, and if you think data is important, having it there. If you want to share lab results, if you think an image is important and will be helpful, you don't want to be running in and out of the room. You want to have that all collected for you. Using understandable language. Being comfortable with silence, and I think this is critically important. People talk a lot about that, you know, once the news is shared and a family has a reaction, what do we tend to do as medical providers? We keep talking, right? We're uncomfortable. We want to just keep talking. We want to try to make it okay. You know what? We can't make it okay. And what parents will relate is that they hear this buzzing noise, and what that buzzing noise is us talking. I'll share kind of a personal thing with you. I was diagnosed with melanoma a while ago. I'm doing totally fine. But the clinician who diagnosed me, who I respected a lot, told me over the phone. And I was giving a talk at the time. And I heard that buzzing noise. And finally I said, you know what? I'm really not hearing what you're saying. Could we meet at 6 o'clock or whatever time to meet? And we did. So remember, once that you give that diagnosis, people don't really hear what you're saying. You can wait. You can pause. Once they make eye contact with you again or are over the emotion, then you can continue. Importance of listening, and also the importance of remaining present. I've given this talk at a lot of different places, and inevitably there's someone in the audience who had a child who died, and afterwards they've oftentimes come up to me and said, please stress this. The words are important, but probably the most important thing to many parents was that a clinician or healthcare provider sat with them after the news. They didn't rush out and and they felt abandoned. They sat with them while they were sobbing, while they were, you know, crying. That meant a lot to them. Also, the importance of demonstrating empathy and not sharing too many facts at a time. Probably three is the most. It's important to anticipate parental and your own reactions and be prepared for those. Anticipate expressions of anger, sadness, guilt. Sometimes there's relief. If a child's been ill for a very long time and has suffered, a parent might feel relieved that the child has died. Acknowledging the parent's emotions, but also never judging. You know, I'm sure some of you who are experienced have had parents collapse in your arms or silently turn around and walk out of the room. I can't tell who of them is grieving. I know both of them are grieving. It's not my place to judge that or make assumptions. People need to grieve in their own ways. And then after the disclosure, encouraging parents to spend time with their child. If the child has died, providing mementos, calling other family members, getting social work, pastoral care involved, and also being available for questions. So these were the components that we really stressed during our seminar, and then we evaluated it. And our residents felt that the SP situations were quite convincing, the reactions were convincing, and that it was instructive. Here were some comments. It couldn't have been more realistic unless we actually did it in the PICU. Another, you can prepare hypothetically only so much. This felt like doing it for real the first time, a luxury before the real first time. And then we asked them about the value. Many felt that it helped them feel more prepared, but they felt they needed more, and that they felt that all residents should have a similar experience in their training. And the words and actions of a medical caretaker do make a difference. Another resident said, all families are different. There is a way to not minimize the trauma, but at least not make it worse. And I learned that no death is routine. So we have disseminated the seminar to Cornell, and that's been a very fun collaboration. And then I was mentioning earlier to your program director that there's an AAP section on palliative care medicine, and there's a group of us that are working on a national curriculum on this, and also with a focus on resiliency. So now for the rest of the session, I'm going to talk about the impact on healthcare providers from their personal and professional experiences. And I developed this conceptual framework looking at there's a patient death, what's the impact on the healthcare provider, and what influences that might be their personal experiences about past deaths or family attitudes or spiritual beliefs or professional experiences such as the number or burden of deaths they've experienced, their level of involvement, and the type of patient deaths. And then working towards long-term integration, what are some of the barriers? One might be provider guilt. So facilitators might be able to debrief or attending a funeral and taking care of yourself. So Showalter once said, the doctor's informal training includes all his life experiences up to the time he treats the patient. And I really believe that. I think this is really a concept in adult learning, right? Everything we've done until that time has really informed us and probably influenced us. So we polled our residents about deaths in their personal life, and 88% responded. 91% had a close personal relationship with someone who died. The majority were grandparents. We asked them what influenced your present attitudes or beliefs about death. 51% said introspection, 43% religious upbringing, and 28% said the death of someone close. We asked, how is the subject of death and dying discussed in your family? And as you can see in red, orange, only 29% said openly. The rest stated some discomfort, the parents had discussed it, but it excluded them as children, or death was never discussed. So this was very powerful data for us to really think about how do we expect trainees or any of us to really address this in a respectful and professional way if you've had very little prior experience. We asked about what's some statement of death that concerns you. One resident said, "What if I've been believing in the wrong God? What if trying to live a good life is not enough? And I occasionally still feel conflicted by my religious upbringing regarding death and the afterlife and my present rather unspiritual beliefs." So what were some professional experiences? This was an article that was published, and this was sent out to attendings in different areas, different disciplines, and also to residents. 61% of all attendings and 73% of specialty attendings said they sometimes considered death a personal failure. In their study, few residents considered death a personal failure, but we did a study later than this and found that actually many residents, in our program anyway, considered it a failure. Going back to that study about emergency physician experiences, 64% reported guilt or inadequacy after unsuccessful pediatric resuscitation. Again, these were experienced faculty members. 39% prolonged resuscitation to delay disclosure. 47% reported feeling impaired the remainder of the shift, and 12% stated it affected their family life. So again, these experiences can have a profound impact on us. So now we'll talk about humanism to self, and that's the importance of acknowledging our imperfections, our fatigue, mistakes, and discomfort with medical uncertainty. I'll go back to Salmasi in The Healer's Calling. He talks about the wounded healer. All healthcare professionals are wounded healers. They cannot escape suffering themselves. Moments of pain, loneliness, fatigue, and sacrifice are intrinsic to the human condition. The physician or nurse's own suffering can become the source of compassion in the healer's art. So I'm going to tell you briefly about one of my wounded healer stories, and it actually kind of has a funny ending, so I hope you'll enjoy this. But does anyone in the audience, anyone know Frank Oski by any chance? Oh, good, good. So a few people did. So Dr. Oski was my chairman when I first went to Hopkins. And he had an annual review where we met with him to, like, review our performance over the past year. So mine was due this day. I was the inpatient ward attending. I'd been on call for 3 weeks. I was really tired. So my goal was to get in, smile a lot, just mad, agree with everything he said. I just wanted to get out, get my work done, and go home. So for those of you who know Dr. Oski, he had a really, really great sense of humor. And at least from my perception, knowing him, I didn't really see him as a very sensitive person. So I went into his office and I sat down. He had a couch in his office. And he walked in and he looked at me and he paused and he said, "Jan, from where do you get your nourishment?" And I, like, again, I was a little sleep deprived, and I was like, is he asking me if I eat in the cafeteria? Like, and if you knew Dr. Oski, like, thank goodness I didn't answer it in that way, because it would have been all over the hospital the next day, like, ha-ha, wasn't that funny? But as I looked at him, and I paused, so for everybody in the audience, says, you know, it's better to pause if you don't know what someone's asking you. I paused, and I looked at him, and it suddenly dawned on me, he cared about me as a person. He could tell I was exhausted, and he was asking me, how am I maintaining my pace during a very busy time? And I have to tell you, that experience was really life-transforming for me, to have a very important person like that care about me so much as a person. And so it's really altered my career, it's altered my research, etc. So in his honor, I'm going to show you a brief clip of Dr. Oski, and this actually is from the Cameron Kravitz Foundation video, because he supported our work.
Physicians must learn to help families grieve. Physicians must not forget that they need help themselves when it comes to supporting others. Doctors don't have an endless wellspring of strength and sympathy. They often need renewal. They often need support from others. And doctors must recognize that they need help and seek help. It's not an admission of guilt or weakness if you can't find the strength to help others. It's a very important thing to be able to help others. It's very important for you to learn to do that. And you may need other people's support in the process of doing that.
So why is that important? Dealing well with human suffering is rewarding, and I think many of us remember instances of feeling very rewarded. However, if it's done poorly, it's a very stressful experience. And when physicians are stressed, we often tend to withdraw from families. The stress and disappointment in themselves may lead to a sense of burnout. And I was just reading some literature on burnout, and, you know, in some articles people are talking about burnout being up to 50% in residents, and also probably a little bit less, but still present in more experienced healthcare providers. And research has shown that dealing well with patients contributed most to physician satisfaction. And this is a quote by Dr. Novak that I really like, and I don't think I do this enough, but I'll put this out as a challenge to all of you in the audience. We have an obligation as educators to share with learners how we have coped with feelings of anger, anguish, shame, or uncertainty in caring for patients. I'm very good at kind of sharing when things have gone well, but probably not so good at sharing when they don't go well. And that can be an equally powerful learning experience, both for yourself and for the people that you educate. So we asked our residents again about their professional experiences with death, and we did it. We divided them between kind of their first half of residency and the latter half. And when you see in the latter half, 53% had been a primary person to inform a family of a patient death. When we look back, all of these were kind of in the middle of the night deaths. 37% felt guilt, 18% felt responsibility. What were their reasons for guilt? Very varied. Some said not aggressive enough treatment, others their own inexperience they felt might have led to the death. They underestimated a patient acuity, should have been more compassionate, or maybe continued too aggressive of treatment. Here were some comments about guilt. A patient of mine died suddenly, diagnosed with cardiomyopathy. I didn't think he looked sick. For many weeks, I felt that I couldn't pick out a sick child. I'm still sad. This is a third-year resident, and what she was referring to was the patient I mentioned at the beginning, that kind of sudden death in the 9-month-old. That child ended up having cardiomyopathy that had been undiagnosed. Another one, in clinic, I saw a patient for a routine 2-week exam. We had concerns about the mother, but let her take the child home. The next week, the infant was brought to the ED in full arrest, diagnosis pending. But I believe it to be child abuse. I then had the opportunity to do a sabbatical in Uganda at Kampala. And I'm showing you, I did a project there that I'll tell you about in a minute. But I took this picture. This is a picture of someone who makes coffins. And this person is stationed right outside the hospital. And the reason for that is because death is really a daily event there. So this was my project. I went there to do the following study. I wanted to examine the reactions and experiences of pediatric residents concerning patient deaths in Kampala and describe their integration strategies and their perceptions for needed support and education. And the reason I chose to go there is that I had colleagues that had worked there, and again, death happens daily. So I thought, here was a group of experienced clinicians where this happens often. Do they either have developed very good strategies on how to integrate this, or maybe they've distanced themselves? Have they become cold to this? And what our study outcomes were was very interesting. Again, in Baltimore, 100% of people remembered their first patient death. In Kampala, 25% remembered their first patient death. When asked to estimate the number of deaths, the mean number was 56, but the range was 5 to 300. And I worked there for several months, and in the unit that I worked on, I worked in the inpatient unit, there were about three deaths a day. So again, it was very common, sadly. Here were comments from the Ugandan residents. A 4-year-old in the hospital had an NG tube. I removed the tube too early. I was told by his parent that the child had aspirated and died. I was devastated. Didn't talk with anyone about it. Another third-year resident, it hurt personally, it hurt so much. So what I learned from this experience is really that they had very similar reactions, that there probably aren't that many cultural differences, but what's the need to kind of support each other during these experiences? We asked about integration strategies. 89% felt that there was an educational reason for a formal mechanism to discuss patient deaths. Some were for emotional support, some were to review decision-making, and also to be better communicators with parents. 93% of the residents said they talked with someone about their patients who died, but the vast majority did it with their colleagues, not with their attendings. So I'm going to talk a little bit about facilitators, and debriefing and attending patient funerals can be facilitators. And in case I don't get back to this later, I just want to say I'm not suggesting you should attend every patient's funeral. That would probably be inappropriate. But there will be patients that you will feel a connection with that might be an important experience. So going back to debriefing, this was a concept developed in the military for soldiers after returning from battle, and it allows a dialogue about events and emotions. And for many of us who've worked in busy EDs, PICUs, outpatient centers, we know sometimes it does feel like you're in battle some days. Attending the patient funeral is a way to offer a means of closure and a forum to express your own grief or loss within a community. We then asked our residents about debriefing, and this is before we had a more formal process for it. And we found out that 74% of residents had debriefed after at least one death, but the mean number was really a small number, and they debriefed after less than 30% of the deaths. Who did they debrief with? It varied. Sometimes it was the entire team, sometimes it was the attending, sometimes colleagues. And I know when I have a tough experience, you know, I make a choice about who am I going to talk to about it. My husband is not in medicine. He's a great guy. If I want someone to tell me, Jan, you're wonderful and you're doing a good job, I talk to my husband. He has no idea, right, if I'm wonderful or doing a good job at work. He doesn't know. But if that's what I need to hear. Conversely, though, if I really want to critically analyze an experience I had, a decision I made, I usually go to valued colleagues and mentors to really critique, could I have done something different? Should I have done something different? And I think that period of self-reflection is really helpful and powerful. We then looked at factors associated with debriefing, and I've become very intrigued with this entity, the inpatient previously healthy patient. So the sudden unexpected deaths are usually the most difficult, unexpected to the family, unexpected to you as healthcare providers, and very important to have some process to review those. This is a painting by Mr. Ellis. It was painted in 1950, and it was entitled Funeral Procession. So 23% of our residents had attended a patient's funeral. When we asked what their fears were of attending a funeral, here were some of their comments. That I would be uncomfortable as I am not family and would represent a failure of medicine and perhaps my own failure. Like I was intruding on a family's grief. What could I say to the family that would make a difference? But we then asked them, you know, for those of who had attended a funeral, what did they remember? And this was one of my favorite quotes. The amazing support of family and friends, a very spiritually meaningful experience. I have seldom felt more love and, surprisingly, a sense of joyful, quiet celebration about the beauty and meaning of a child's life. And I think for those of you who have had the opportunity to attend a funeral, I oftentimes have felt this way. It often demonstrates a tremendous amount of respect to that family. Sometimes they ask you to speak at the funeral. It can be a very meaningful experience. Lastly, I'm just going to talk about acknowledging our own humanism. And there's not a lot of literature on this. There's a group, including myself, who's trying to work more on this. But how do we renew ourselves to maintain the joy and meaning in our work? So it's important to stress well-being, and that goes beyond absence of distress. It's being challenged, it's thriving in both our personal and professional life. And the strategies to promote well-being, one size does not fit all. What works for me may not work for other people in the audience or may work for a portion of you. This is really something you've got to determine on your own, but I think it's very important to do so. Here's some of the literature on well-being, and there's about 6 articles that have been published on this. But what's remarkable is that the themes are very similar, and I'm at least going to share with you some of the themes. So what is your approach to life? Making sure that you have meaning in your work. Is what you're doing meaningful to you at a personal and professional level? Maintaining your sense of humor is important. Keeping your perspective, having time for play. Celebrating successes, I think that's important to emphasize. I know I don't do that enough. We tend to focus on the things that go wrong, but how many encounters do you have that are really positive and wonderful and like really acknowledging that? And then a daily release ritual to let go of the day's concerns. You know, how do you kind of make that break when you go home to really just focus on home? And that can vary. It could be listening to music on the way home. It could be taking a shower when you go home, going for a run. I'll share this with you. I don't do this often, but I had a particularly bad day maybe about 2 months ago, and I was driving home on the freeway, and I just turned the radio up, and I screamed for like a minute. And I told the residents this. They were pretty shocked because I don't think I'm perceived as a screamer usually. But I felt so good. And I went home and get my Hudson's down a physician. I was cheery. I was happy. So again, figuring out some way, how do you kind of let go of some of the frustrations of the day? Other things, a means to express your emotions. All of the authors talk about the importance of taking time to grieve losses. You've got to have some way to do that. Having time alone or reflection, debriefing or talking with others, or journaling. Also, relationship with others, the importance to connect with family and friends. And Steve Ludwig talks about this, which I really like. A lot of your work relationships are almost like your second family. So developing that that closeness or that connection with your coworkers can be really helpful. Setting and maintaining boundaries and also giving yourself permission to say no if it's something that either you are not interested in or you just feel like your time does not allow. Some have spiritual and religious beliefs, so believing in something beyond yourself. And that doesn't have to be in God necessarily. It could be in a community effort. Prayer, meditation, and then finally wellness and self-care. Developing good sleep hygiene. We all know that when you sleep better, you're in a better mood, you're more effective. Taking care of your mental and medical health care. For those of you who enjoy this, exercise and yoga. For me, time in nature is very rewarding, and it helps me gain perspective, relaxation and vacations, and also hobbies. So I'm going to close with this, with these conclusions. Humanism is a critical component in the practice of medicine. Humanism is essential to be effective in end-of-life experiences, and I would actually say probably in everyday care. Educational interventions appear to be beneficial in sharing bad news. While continuing to provide support to parents and families, healthcare professionals must also learn the importance of their own well-being. And here's a painting that I think is familiar to most of you in the audience, The Doctor by Sir Luc Feles in 1891. This was painted, I believe it was 14 or 15 years after his child died. But what I really appreciate about this patient is here's the physician kind of at vigil with the patient. And again, I think it demonstrates remaining present. So when technology isn't available, our relationship is still very important to remain present with our families and patients. I'd like to acknowledge the Cameron Kravitz Foundation and faculty collaborators, and then I will take any questions. Thank you for your attention. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.